Chapter 23. Swallows were flying around the bomb-torn tower. The first of the sun sparkled on the broken edges of the roof tiles. Graybrun packed his alcohol stove. He did not know whether cooking was allowed, but he decided to follow the old soldier's rule: act before anyone can forbid you. He took his mess kit and went to look for a faucet. He found one behind the station of the crucifixion. A man with mouth open and red stubble on his face was sleeping there. He had only one leg. His unstrapped prosthesis lay beside him. In the early light, its nickel supports glittered like a machine. Graber glanced through the open colonnade into the cloisters. The sexton had been right. The sexes were separate. On the south side, there were only women sleeping. As he was coming back, Elizabeth woke up. She looked fresh and rested, not like the sallow faces he had seen in the cloisters. "I know where you can wash," he said. "Go there before the crowd collects. Religious organizations always have inadequate sanitary arrangements. Come, I'll show you the washroom for cathedral canons." She laughed. "You stay here and keep an eye on the coffee, otherwise it will disappear. I'll be able to find the washroom by myself. Which way do I go?" He described the way. She walked through the garden. She had slept so peacefully that her dress was hardly wrinkled. He looked after her and loved her very much.
"So you are cooking in the garden of the Lord," the pious sexton had stolen up on felt soles. "And what's worse, at the station of the sorrowful crown of thorns."
"Where's the joyous one? I'd just as soon go there."
"This is all holy ground. Can't you see that the cathedral canons are buried over there?"
"I have sat and cooked in many a cemetery before now," Graber said calmly. "But tell me where we are to go. Is there any sort of canteen or field kitchen here?"
"Canteen?" The sexton mouthed the word like a rotten fruit. "Here?"
"It wouldn't be a bad idea."
"Perhaps for heathen like you. Fortunately, there are people who think differently. A restaurant on Christ's ground. What blasphemy!"
"It's not such a blasphemy. Christ fed a couple of thousand people with a few loaves and fishes, as you ought to know. But he was not a pompous raven like you. And now clear out. There's a war on. Perhaps that idea is new to you."
"I will inform Herr Pastor Biedendieck of your sacrilege."
"Do that. He'll throw you out, you tedious creep."
The sexton went back, dignified and furious, in his felt shoes. Graber opened a packet of coffee, part of the legacy from Binding, and smelled it. It was bean coffee. He began to prepare it. The aroma spread and produced an immediate effect. From behind the grave of a cathedral canon, a man's tousled head rose sniffing. Then he sneezed, got up, and came closer.
"How about a cup?"
"Push off," Graber said. "This is the house of God. They don't give alms here. They just take them."
Elizabeth came back. She moved lithely and limberly as though strolling.
"Where did you get the real coffee?"
she asked in amazement.
"It's from Binding. We must drink it quickly, otherwise we'll be overrun by the whole cloister."
The sun glided over the statue of the sorrowful crown of thorns. Near the bench at the station of the scourging, a patch of ground was purple with violets. Graber got bread and butter out of his knapsack. He cut the bread with his pocket knife and spread the butter.
"Real butter," Elizabeth said. "From Binding, too?"
"Everything."
"Strange, he did me nothing but kindness, and I never really liked him."
"Perhaps that's why he did it. Things like that happen."
Elizabeth sat down beside Graber on the knapsack.
"When I was 7 years old, I wanted to live just like this.
I wanted to be a baker."
She laughed.
"Instead of that, you've become a provider. The best. How late is it?"
"I'll pack up and take you to the factory."
"No, let's stay here in the sun as long as we can. Packing up and putting away our things will take too long, and we'd have a long wait before we could get all our things stored downstairs. The cloister is full of people already. You can do it later when I've gone."
"All right. Do you think we're allowed to smoke here?"
"No, but that certainly won't bother you."
"No. Let's enjoy all we can before we're thrown out. It won't be long. Today I'll try to find a place where we won't have to sleep in our clothes. We don't want to go to Pastor Biedendieck in any case, do we?
No. I'd rather go back to Polmont's.
The sun rose higher. It fell upon the portico and threw the shadows of the columns against the walls. The people there moved back and forth through a lattice of light and shade, as though in prison. Children were crying. The one-legged man in the corner of the garden strapped on his artificial leg and pulled his trousers on over it. Graeber packed up the bread, butter, and coffee. "It's 8:10, he said. "You must go. I'll come and get you at the factory, Elizabeth. If anything happens, we have 2 meeting places. Frau Witte's garden first. If not there, then here."
"Yes," Elizabeth got up. "It's the last time I'll have to go away for the day."
"We'll stay up for a long time tonight. Hours and hours. That will make up for the wasted day." She kissed him and left quickly. Graeber heard someone laugh. He turned angrily. A young woman stood between the columns, holding on to a little boy who was standing on top of the wall. The child was snatching at her hair, and she was laughing with him. She had not seen Graeber and Elizabeth at all. He packed up his things. Then he went to rinse out his mess kit. The amputee came after him, his legs stamping and creaking.
"Hey there, comrade," Graeber stopped. "Wasn't it you that had the coffee?"
the amputee asked. "Yes, we drank it all."
"That's clear."
The man had very wide blue eyes.
"What I mean is the coffee grounds. If you're going to throw them away, give them to me instead. They can be cooked up again."
"Yes, of course." Graeber scraped out the coffee grounds. Then he got his things and took them to the place where they could be left. He expected a battle with the pious sexton, but instead of him, the other red-nosed one was there. He smelled of communion wine and said nothing. The warden was sitting at the window of his apartment in the burned house. He waved when he saw Graeber. Graeber went in.
"Have you any mail for us?"
"Yes, for your wife. The letter is addressed to Fräulein Kruse."
"That's quite in order, eh?"
"Yes."
Graeber took the letter. It struck him that the block warden was watching him strangely. He glanced at the letter and went numb. It was from the Gestapo. He turned the envelope over. It was sealed as though someone had already opened it.
"When did it come?"
he asked.
"Yesterday evening."
Graeber looked at the flap. He felt sure the block warden had read the letter, and so he pushed up the flap and took it out. It was a summons for Elizabeth to appear at 11:30 that morning. He looked at his watch. It was just before 10.
"Good," he said. "At last. I've been waiting for this for a long time."
He put the letter into his pocket.
"Anything else?"
"Isn't that enough?"
the warden asked with an inquisitive glance. Graeber laughed.
"Don't you know of an apartment for us?"
"No. Do you still need one?"
"Not for me, but my wife does."
"So?"
the block warden said without conviction.
"Yes, I would even pay a good premium to get one."
"So?"
the block warden said again. Graeber walked away. He felt the warden watching him through the window. He stopped and acted as though he were examining the skeleton of the roof with interest. Then he wandered on slowly. Around the next corner, he got out the letter at once. It was a printed form from which it was impossible to tell anything. Even the signature was printed. Only Elizabeth's name and the date had been typed in on a machine that made the A's too high. He stared at the paper. It was an oblong piece of cheap gray pulp paper in octavo size, but it suddenly seemed to blot out the world. An intangible threat rose from it. It smelled of death. He was standing in front of the Katharinenkirche and did not know how he had got there.
"Ernst,"
someone behind him whispered. He whirled around. It was Josef. He was wearing an overcoat of military cut, and he walked on into the church without taking further notice of Graeber. Graeber looked around, and a minute later followed him in. He found him in an empty pew near the sacristy. Josef gestured cautiously. Graeber went up to the altar, turned back, and knelt down beside him.
"Polmann has been arrested,"
Josef whispered.
"What?" "Polmann. The Gestapo came and got him this morning.
For a moment, Graeber was not sure whether Polman's arrest might not have had something to do with the letter to Elizabeth. He stared at Josef.
So Polman too?
He said finally. Josef looked up quickly.
Who else?
My wife has received a summons from the Gestapo.
For when?
For this morning at 11:30.
Have you the summons with you?
Yes, here.
Graeber gave Josef the letter.
How did it happen with Polman?
He asked.
I don't know. I wasn't there. When I came back, I could tell what had happened from a stone that was lying in a different place. Polman had kicked it to one side as he was being taken away. That was one of our signals. An hour later, I saw his books being loaded into a car.
Was there anything there to incriminate him?
I don't think so. Everything that was dangerous had been buried somewhere else, even the canned goods.
Graeber looked at the paper in Josef's hand.
I was just going to go and see him, he said. I wanted to ask him what I ought to do.
That's why I came here to warn you. It's pretty certain there's an agent of the Gestapo waiting in his room.
Josef returned the summons to Graeber.
What are you going to do?
I don't know. I just got it. What would you do?
Flee,
Josef replied without hesitation. Graeber stared into the semi-darkness where the altars gleamed.
I'll go there by myself and ask what they want, he said.
They won't give you any information if it's your wife they want.
Graeber felt a chill at the back of his neck, but Josef was just being matter of fact.
If they wanted to get hold of my wife, they would have arrested her like Polman. It must be something else. That's why I intend to go. Perhaps it's nothing important,
he said without conviction.
In that case, it would be a mistake to flee.
Is your wife Jewish?
No.
Then it's different. Jews should always flee.
Can't your wife be on a trip somewhere? No, she's in the labor service. That's a matter of record.
Josef reflected.
It's possible they don't intend to arrest her.
You are right. They could have done that directly.
Have you any idea why she was summoned?
Her father is in a concentration camp, and there was a woman she was staying with who might have denounced her. It's possible, too, that she came to their attention because we got married.
Josef reflected once more.
Destroy everything that might have any bearing on her father's arrest. Letters, diaries, all that sort of stuff. And then go, by yourself.
That was what you intended to do, wasn't it?
Yes. I'll explain that the letter only arrived this morning and I couldn't reach my wife in the factory.
That's best. Try to find out what's going on. Not much can happen to you. You have to go back to the front anyway. They won't keep you from doing that. If you need a hiding place for your wife, I can give you an address. But go first. I'll be here this afternoon.
Josef hesitated for a moment.
In Pastor Biedendieck's confessional box.
There, where the sign saying absent is hanging. Graeber got up and went out. After the cool semi-darkness of the church, the light outside burst upon him as though it were trying to shine through him and were already an instrument of the Gestapo. He walked slowly through the streets. It was as if he were walking under a bell glass. Everything around him was suddenly strange and unreachable. A woman with a child in her arms became a picture of personal safety that inspired bitter envy. A man sitting on a bench reading a newspaper was an example of unattainable serenity. And two laughing people seemed like beings from an earlier world that had suddenly been destroyed. Over him alone hung the dark shadow of fear, separating him from others as though he were plague-stricken. He entered the Gestapo building and showed the summons. An SS man directed him along a corridor into a side wing. The passages smelled of unaired offices and barracks. He had to wait in a room with three other people. One man was standing at a window that opened on the courtyard. His hands were behind his back, and with his right hand, he was tapping out piano notes on the back of his left hand. The two other men were slumped on chairs, staring straight ahead. One was bald-headed and had a hair lip, which he kept covering with his hand. The other wore a Hitler mustache and had a pale, spongy face. All three glanced over quickly at Graeber as he came in, and then immediately looked away again. An SS man with eyeglasses entered. They all got up at once. Graeber was nearest the door.
What are you doing here?
The SS man asked in surprise. Soldiers were usually under the authority of the military court. Graeber showed him the notice. The SS man read it.
This isn't for you at all. This is for Fräulein Kruse.
She's my wife. We were married a few days ago. She works in one of the state industries. I thought I could attend to this for her. Graeber got out his marriage certificate, which he had brought with him out of foresight. The SS man bored into his ear with one finger, reflectively.
Well, it's all right with me. Room 72, cellar floor.
He returned Graeber's papers. The cellar floor, Graeber thought. The cellar floor was the most infamous place of all in the stories about the Gestapo building. He went down the stairs. Two people coming toward him stared at him enviously. They thought he was going out a free man, while they still had it all to face. Room 72 was a large hall with filing cases and partitioned offices. A board official took Graeber's notice. Graeber explained to him why he had come and showed his papers once more. The official nodded.
Can you sign for your wife?
Yes. The official pushed two sheets of paper across the table.
Sign here, right under the signature, Husband of Elisabeth Kruse, and add the date and the registry office of your marriage. You may take the second form with you.
Graeber signed slowly. He did not want to show that he was reading the printed matter, but he did not want to sign blindly either. Meanwhile, the official was looking about in one of the filing cabinets.
Damn it! Where are those ashes?
He shouted finally.
Holtmann, you've got everything in a mess again. Bring out the cruiser package.
Someone behind the partition grunted. Graeber saw that he had signed a receipt for the ashes of Bernhard Kruse, prisoner in protective custody. In addition, he saw on the second form that Bernhard Kruse had died of heart disease. The official had gone behind the partition. Now he came back with a cigar box that had been wrapped in a too small piece of brown paper and was tied with a string. On the sides was the word Claro, and part of the bright cover of the cigar box was visible. It was a coat of arms in red and gold held aloft by a pipe-smoking Indian.
Here are the ashes,
the official said, looking sleepily at Graeber. Since you are a soldier, I hardly need to tell you that the most complete silence is mandatory. No death notice, either in the papers or sent as an announcement through the mails. No funeral service. Silence. Understand?
Yes.
Graeber took the cigar box and left. He decided at once to say nothing to Elisabeth. He would leave it to chance whether she found out later. It was not likely. The Gestapo did not repeat its messages. For the present, he felt it was enough to have to leave her in a few days. To tell her in addition that her father was dead would be an unnecessary cruelty. He walked back slowly to the Katharinenkirche. The streets seemed suddenly full of life again. The threat was past. It had transformed itself into death, but it was the death of a stranger. He had only known Elisabeth's father in his childhood. He felt the cigar box under his arm. Very likely it did not contain Kruse's ashes at all. Holtmann could easily have made a mistake, and it was hardly to be assumed that people in a concentration camp took much pains with such matters. Besides, it would not be possible with mass incinerations. Some stoker would shovel out a few handfuls of ashes and pack them up, that was all. Graeber could not understand why it was done at all. It was a mixture of inhumanity and bureaucracy which made the inhumanity all the more inhumane. He considered what to do with the ashes. He could bury them somewhere in the ruins. There were plenty of opportunities for that. Or he could try to get them into a cemetery, but that would require a permit and a grave, and Elisabeth would find out. He walked through the church. In front of Pastor Biedendieck's confessional box, he stopped. The absent sign was out. He pushed the green curtain aside. Josef was looking at him. He was awake and sitting in such a way that he could have kicked Graeber in the stomach and run away instantly. Graeber walked past to the pew near the sacristy. After a while, Josef came. Graeber pointed to the cigar box. It was that. Her father's ashes.
Nothing more?
That's enough. Have you found out anything more about Polman?
No.
They both looked at the package.
A cigar box, Josef said. Usually they use old cardboard boxes or tin cans or paper bags. A cigar box is really almost like a coffin.
Where are you going to put it?
Here in the church?
Graeber shook his head. It had suddenly occurred to him what to do. In the cloister garden, he said. That's really a kind of cemetery?
Josef nodded.
How about you? Can I do anything for you?
Graeber asked. You can go out through the side door over there and see whether anything suspicious is going on in the street.
I have to leave. The anti-Semitic sexton is on duty after 1 o'clock. If you don't come back in 5 minutes, I'll assume the street is clear.
All right.
Graeber stood in the sun.
After a while, Josef came out of the door. He walked by close to Graeber.
Good luck,
he murmured.
Good luck.
Graeber walked back. The cloister garden was empty at this time. Two yellow butterflies with red dots on their wings were playing around a bush covered with tiny white blossoms. The bush stood beside the grave of the cathedral capitulary Aloysius Blume.
Graeber went up and examined it. Three of the graves were sunken, but Blume's in such a way that a hollow seemed to extend under the grassy surface. It was a good place. He wrote a note saying these were the ashes of a Catholic prisoner from a concentration camp. He did this in case the cigar box should be discovered. He tucked the note under the brown paper. With his bayonet, he cut away a piece of grass and cautiously enlarged the crevice under it until the box would fit in. It was easy to do. He pressed back into the hole the earth he had scraped out and arranged the grass over it. Bernhard Kruse, if that's who it was, had thus found a resting place in consecrated ground at the feet of a high dignitary of the church. Graeber went back and seated himself on the cloister wall. The stones were warm from the sun. Perhaps I have committed a sacrilege, he thought. Or perhaps it was only a gratuitous act of sentimentality. Bernhard Kruse had been a Catholic. Cremation was forbidden to Catholics. But the church would no doubt have to overlook this because of the unusual circumstances. And if it was not Kruse at all in the box, but the ashes of various victims, among them perhaps Protestants and Orthodox Jews, even then it would probably be all right, he thought. Neither Jehovah nor the God of the Protestants nor the God of the Catholics could very much object to that. He looked at the grave into which the cigar box had been slipped like a cuckoo's egg into a nest. At the time, he had not felt much. But now, after it was all over, he experienced a deep and boundless bitterness. It was more than just the thought of Kruse. Polman was in it, and Josef, and all the misery he had seen, and the war, and even his own fate. He got up. He had seen in Paris the grave of the unknown soldier, ostentatious under the Arc de Triomphe, on which the great battles of France were chiseled. And suddenly it seemed to him as if this sunken plot of grass, with the funeral slab of the cathedral capitulary Blumer and the cigar box underneath, was something of the same kind, and perhaps even more so, because it was not surrounded by the rainbow of glory and of battles.
Where are we going to sleep tonight? Elizabeth asked. In the church?
No. A miracle has happened.
I was at Frau Witte's.
She has a spare room. Her daughter moved to the country a few days ago. We can stay there and perhaps you can even keep the room after I've gone.
I have already taken all our things over.
Did your vacation come through?
Yes. I don't have to go back, and you don't have to wait for me anymore.
Thank God. We'll celebrate that tonight. We'll stay up all night and sleep until noon tomorrow.
Yes. We'll sit in the garden till all the stars are out. But first, I am going to hurry and buy a hat.
A hat? Graeber asked.
Yes. This is the day to do it.
What are you going to do with a hat? Do you intend to wear it in the garden tonight?
Elizabeth laughed.
That too, perhaps. But that's not the point. The point is to buy it. It's a symbolic action. A hat's like a flag. It can mean anything. You buy one when you are happy or when you are unhappy. You don't understand that, do you?
No, but let's buy one if that's the way it is. We'll celebrate your freedom with it. That's more important than dinner. Are there any stores still open? And don't you need clothing coupons? I have them, and I know a store where they have hats. Good. We'll buy a hat to go with your garden dress. You don't need a hat with that. It's an evening dress. We'll simply buy any sort of hat. It's absolutely essential. Buying it will do away with the factory. Part of the store window was intact. The rest was boarded up. They peered in. There were two hats there. One was trimmed with artificial flowers, the other with bright feathers. Graeber regarded them doubtfully. He could not picture Elizabeth in either one. Then he saw a white-haired woman locking the door. Quick, he said. The owner led them into a room behind the store where the windows were blacked out. She immediately began a conversation with Elizabeth of which Graeber understood nothing. He seated himself on a fragile gold chair near the door. The owner switched on the light in front of a mirror and began to bring out hats and materials from cardboard boxes. The gray store suddenly became a magic cave. The blue and red and rose and white of the hats flamed out and, shimmering among them, the golden stuff of brocades made them seem like crowns being tried on for a mysterious ceremonial. Elizabeth moved back and forth in the flood of light in front of the mirrors as though she had just stepped out of a picture, and the twilight that shrouded the rest of the room closed like a curtain behind her. Graeber sat there very still, observing the scene which seemed unreal to him after all that had happened that day. He saw Elizabeth for the first time fully detached from time, by herself, absorbed in an unconstrained and profound play, bathed in light and tenderness and love, serious and self-possessed as a huntress testing her weapons for battle. He heard the quiet conversation of the two without listening to it, and it was like the murmur of a spring. He saw the bright circle that surrounded Elizabeth as though emanating from her, and he loved her and desired her and forgot all else in this silent happiness, behind which stood the unseizable shadow of loss, making it only deeper, more glowing, and as costly and fugitive as the glints on the silks and brocades.
A cap, Elizabeth said. A simple gold cap that fits close to the head.